But foremost among those things I was incapable of doing was denying Aeneia. Yes, I said, I will do anything you ask. At that moment, I knew that I was lost and resurrected. Aeneia did not speak then, but only nodded, squeezed my hand a final time, and turned back to the light, the cake, and our waiting android friend. On the next day, I was to learn what her request truly meant, and how difficult it would be to honor my vow.
I will stop for a moment. I realize that you might not know about me, unless you have read the first few hundred pages of my tale, which, because I had to recycle the microvellum upon which I wrote them, no longer exist, except in the memory of this scriber. I told the truth in those lost pages, or at least the truth as I knew it then, or at least I tried to tell the truth. Mostly. After having recycled the microvellum pages of that first attempt to tell the story of Aeneia, and because the scriber has never been out of my sight, I have to assume that no one has read them. The fact that they were written in a Schrodinger cat box execution egg in exile orbit around the barren world of Armagast, the cat box being little more than a fixed position energy shell holding my atmosphere, air, and food recycling equipment, bed, table, scriber, and a vial of cyanide gas waiting to be released by a random isotope emission, would seem to have ensured that you have not read those pages. But I am not sure. Strange things were happening then. Strange things have happened since. I will reserve judgment on whether those pages and these could ever have been, or ever will be, read. In the meantime, I will reintroduce myself. My name is Rawl Endymion, my first name rhyming with tall, which I am, and my last name deriving from the abandoned university city of Endymion on the backwater world of Hyperion. I qualify the word abandoned because that quarantine city is where I met the old poet, Martin Silenus, the ancient author of the banned epic poem The Kantos, and that is where my adventure began. I use the word adventure with some irony, and perhaps in the sense that all of life is an adventure. For it is true that while the voyage began as an adventure, an attempt to rescue 12-year-old Aeneia from the Pax and to escort her safely to the distant old Earth, it has since become a full lifetime of love, loss, and wonder. Anyway, at the time of this telling, during the week of the Pope's death, the old architect's death, and Aeneia's inauspicious 16th birthday in exile, I was 32 years old, still tall, still strong, still trained mostly in hunting, brawling, and watching others lead, still callow, and just teetering on the precipice of falling forever in love with the girl child I had protected like a little sister, and who, overnight it seemed, had become a girl woman, whom I knew now as a friend. I should also say that the other things I write of here, the events in Pax Space, the murder of Paul Duray, the retrieval of the female thing named Radamanth Nemes, the thoughts of Father Federico de Soya, are not surmised or extrapolated or made up in the way that the old fiction novels were in Martin Silenus's day. I know these things, down to the level of Father de Soya's thoughts and Counselor Albedo's apparel that day. Not because I am omniscient, but because of later events and revelations that gave access to such omniscience. It will make sense later. At least I hope it will. I apologize for this awkward reintroduction. The template for Aeneia's cybrid father, a poet named John Keats, said in his last letter of farewell to his friends, "I have always made an awkward bow. In truth, so have I." Whether in departure or greeting or, as is perhaps the case here, an improbable reunion. So I will return to my memories and ask your indulgence if they do not make perfect sense at my first attempt to share and shape them. The wind howled and the dust blew for 3 days and 3 nights after Aeneia's 16th birthday. The girl was gone for all that time. Over the past 4 years, I had grown used to her time-outs, as she called them, and I usually did not fret the way I had the first few times she had disappeared for days on end. This time, however, I was more concerned than usual. The death of the old architect had left the 27 apprentices and the 60-some support people at the desert camp, which is what the old architect called Taliesin West, anxious and uneasy. The dust storm added to that anxiety, as dust storms always do. Most of the families and support staff lived close by, in one of the desert masonry dormitories Mr. Wright had his interns build south of the main buildings, and the camp complex itself was almost fort-like, with its walls and courtyards and covered walkways, good for scuttling between buildings during a dust storm. But each successive day without either sunlight or a Nia made me increasingly nervous. Several times each day I went to her apprentice shelter. It was the farthest from the main compound, almost a quarter of a mile north toward the mountains. She was never there. She had left the door untethered and a note telling me not to worry, that it was just one of her excursions and that she was taking plenty of water. But every time I visited, I appreciated her shelter more. 4 years earlier, when she and I had first arrived with a dropship stolen from a Pax warship, both of us exhausted, battered and burned, not to mention with an android healing in the ship's auto-surgeon, the old architect and the other apprentices had greeted us with warmth and acceptance. Mr. Wright had not seemed surprised that a 12-year-old child had come across world after world via Farcaster to find him and to ask to be his apprentice. I remember that first day when the old architect had asked her what she knew of architecture. "Nothing," Ania had replied quietly, "except that you are the one I should learn from." Evidently, this had been the correct response. Mr. Wright had told her that all of the apprentices who had arrived before her, all 26 others as it turned out, had been asked to design and build their own shelters in the desert as a sort of entry exam. The old architect had offered some crude materials from the compound, canvas, stone, cement, a bit of cast-off lumber. But the design and effort were up to the girl. Before she set to work, not being an apprentice, I made do with a tent close to the main compound. Ania and I toured the other apprentice shelters. Most were variations on tent shacks. They were serviceable and showed some style. One particularly exhibited a nice design flair, but, as Ania pointed out to me, would not keep the sand or rain out with the slightest wind. But none was particularly memorable. Ania worked 11 days on her shelter. I helped her do some of the heavy lifting and a bit of the excavating. Abetic was still recovering at that time, first in the auto surgeon, then in the compound's infirmary. But the girl did all of the planning and most of the work. The result was this wonderful shelter that I visited 4 times a day during this, her last hiatus in the desert. Ania had excavated the main sections of the shelter so that most of it was below ground level. Then she had set flagstones in place, making sure that they fit tightly to create a smooth floor. Over the stones, she set colorful rugs and blankets she traded for at the Indian market 15 miles away. Around the excavated core of the home, she set walls that were about 1 meter high, but with the sunken main room, they seemed taller. They were constructed of the same rough desert masonry that Mr. Wright had used in building the walls and superstructure of the main compound buildings, and Ania used the same technique, although she had never heard him describe it. First, she gathered stones from the desert and the many arroyos and washes around the hilltop compound. The rocks were of every size and color, purple, black, rusty reds, and deep umbers, and some held petroglyphs or fossils. After gathering the stones, Ania built wooden forms and set the larger rocks in with their flat sides against the inside face of the form. She then spent days in the broiling sun, shoveling sand from the washes and carting it back to her building site in wheelbarrows, mixing it there with cement to form the concrete that held the stones in place as the mixture hardened. It was a rough concrete stone concoction, desert masonry, Mr. Wright called it, but it was strangely beautiful. the colorful rocks showing through the surface of the concrete, fissures and textures everywhere. Once in place, the walls were about a meter high and thick enough to hold out the desert heat in the daytime and hold in the inner heat at night. Her shelter was more complex than at first appeared to the eye. It was months before I appreciated the subtle trick she had pulled in its design. One duct to enter the vestibule, a stone and canvas porte-cochere, with three broad steps leading one down and around to the wood and masonry portal that served as the entrance to the main room. This twisting, descending vestibule acted as a sort of airlock, sealing out the desert sand and harshness. And the way she had rigged the canvas, almost like overlapping jib sails, improved the airlock effect. The main room was only 3 meters across and 5 long, but it seemed much larger. Ania had used built-in benches around a raised stone table to create a dining and sitting area, and then placed more niches and stone seats near a hearth she had fashioned in the north wall of the shelter. There was an actual stone chimney built into the wall, and it did not touch the canvas or wood at any point. Between the stone walls and the canvas, at about eye height when seated, she had rigged screened windows that ran the length of the north and south sides of the shelter. These panoramic view slits could be battened down by both canvas and sliding wood shutters, operated from the inside. Overhead, she had used old fiberglass rods found in the compound junk heap to shape the canvas in smooth arches, sudden peaks, cathedral vaults, and odd folded niches. She had actually fashioned a bedroom for herself. Again, removed from the main room by 2 steps, twisted at 60-degree angles, the entire niche built into the gently rising slope and set back against a huge boulder she had found on the site. There was no water or plumbing out here. We all shared the communal showers and toilets in the compound annex. But Ania had built a lovely little rock basin and bath next to her bed, a plywood platform with mattress and blankets. And several times a week she would heat water in the main kitchen and carry it out to her shelter, bucket by bucket, for a hot bath. The light through the canvas ceilings and walls was warm at sunrise, buttery at midday, and orange in the evening. In addition, Ania had deliberately placed the shelter in careful relation to saguaros, prickly pear bushes, and staghorn cactus, so that different shadows would fall on different planes of canvas at different times of day. It was a comfortable, pleasant place, and empty beyond description when my young friend was absent. I mentioned that the apprentices and support staff were anxious after the old architect's death. Distraught might be a better word. I spent most of those 3 days of Ania's absence listening to the concerned babble of almost 90 people. Never together, since even the dinner shifts in the dining hall were spaced apart because Mr. Wright had not liked huge crowds at dinner. And the level of panic seemed to grow as the days and dust storms went by. Ania's absence was a big part of the hysteria. She was the youngest apprentice at Taliesin. The youngest person, actually. But the others had grown used to asking advice of her and of listening when she spoke. In 1 week, they had lost both their mentor and their guide. On the 4th morning after her birthday, the dust storms ended and Ania returned. I happened to be out jogging just after sunrise and saw her coming across the desert from the direction of the McDowell Mountains. She was silhouetted in the morning light, a thin figure with short hair against the corona brilliance. And in that second I thought of the first time I had seen her in the Valley of the Time Tombs on Hyperion. She grinned when she saw me. "Hey, Boo," she called. It was an old joke based on some book she had read as a very young child. "Hey, Scout," I called back, answering in the same in-joke language. We stopped when we were 5 paces apart. My impulse was to hug her and hold her close and beg her not to disappear again. I did not do that. The rich, low light of morning threw long shadows behind the chola cacti, grease bushes, and sage and bathed our already sunburned skin in an orange glow. "How are the troops doing?" asked Ania. I could see that despite her promises to the contrary, she had been fasting during the past 3 days. She had always been thin, but now her ribs almost showed through her thin cotton shirt. Her lips were dry and cracked.
"They upset?" she said.
"They're shitting bricks," I said. For years I'd avoided using my home guard vocabulary around the kid, but she was 16 now. Besides, she had always used a saltier vocabulary than I knew. Ania grinned. The brilliant light illuminated the sandy streaks in her short hair.
"That'd be good for a bunch of architects, I guess."
I rubbed my chin, feeling the rough stubble there. "Seriously, kiddo, they're pretty upset." Ania nodded.
"Yeah, they don't know what to do or where to go now that Mr. Wright's gone."
She squinted toward the fellowship compound, which showed up as little more than asymmetrical bits of stone and canvas, just visible above the cacti and scrub brush. Sunlight glinted off unseen windows in one of the fountains.
"Let's get everybody in the music pavilion and talk," said Ania,
and began striding toward Taliesin. And thus began our last full day together on Earth. I am going to interrupt myself here. I hear my own voice on the scriber, and remember the pause in the telling at this point. What I wanted to do here was tell all about the 4 years of exile on old Earth, all about the apprentices and other people at the Taliesin Fellowship, all about the old architect and his whims and petty cruelties, as well as about his brilliance and childlike enthusiasms. I wanted to describe the many conversations with Ania over those 48 local months, which, as I never got tired of being amazed by, corresponded perfectly to Hegemony Pack's standard months, and my slow growth of understanding of her incredible insights and abilities. Finally, I wanted to tell of all my excursions during that time, my trip around the Earth in the dropship, the long driving adventures in North America, my fleeting contact with the other islands of humanity huddled around cybrid figures from the human past, the gathering in Israel and New Palestine around the cybrid Jesus of Nazareth was a memorable group to visit. But primarily, when I hear the brief silence on the scriber that took the place of these tales, I remember the reason for my omission. As I said before, I scribed these words in the Schrödinger cat box orbiting Armagast, while awaiting the simultaneous emission of an isotropic particle and the activation of the particle detector. When these two events coincided, the cyanide gas built into the static energy field around the recycling equipment would be released. Death would not be instantaneous, but near enough. While protesting earlier that I would take my time in telling our story, Ania's and mine, I realize now that there was some editing, some attempt to get to the important elements before the particle decayed and the gas flowed. I will not double-guess that decision now, except to say that the 4 years on Earth would be worth telling about at some other point in time. The 90 people of the Fellowship were decent, complex, devious, and interesting in the way of all intelligent human beings, and their tales should be told. Similarly, my explorations across Earth, both in the dropship and in the 1948 Woody station wagon that the old architect loaned me, might support an epic poem of their own. But I am not a poet. But I was a tracker in my hunting guide days, and my job here is to follow the path of Ania's growth to womanhood and messiahship without wandering down too many sidetracks. And so I shall. The old architect always referred to the fellowship compound as Desert Camp. Most of the apprentices referred to it as Taliesin, which means shining brow in Welsh. Mr. Wright was of Welsh extraction. I spent weeks trying to remember a Pax or Outback world named Welsh before I remembered that the old architect had lived and died before spaceflight. Ania often referred to the place as Taliesin West, which suggested to even someone as dull as me that there had to be a Taliesin East. When I asked her 3 years earlier
Aniya had explained that the original Mr. Wright had built his first Taliesin Fellowship compound in the early 1930s in Spring Green, Wisconsin, Wisconsin being one of the political and geographical subunits of the ancient North American nation-state called the United States of America. When I asked Aniya if the first Taliesin was like this one, she had said, "Not really. There were a series of Wisconsin Taliesins, both homes and fellowship compounds, and most were destroyed by fire. That's one of the reasons Mr. Wright installed so many pools and fountains here at this compound, sources of water to fight the inevitable fires." "And his first Taliesin was built in the 1930s? I said. Aniya shook her head. "He opened his first Taliesin fellowship in 1932, she said. "But that was mostly a way to get slave labor from his apprentices, both for building his dream and raising food for him during the Depression." "What was the Depression?" "Bad economic times in their pure capitalist nation-state," Aniya said. "Remember, the economy wasn't really global then, and it depended upon private money institutions called banks, gold reserves, and the value of physical money, actual coins and pieces of paper that were supposed to be worth something. It was all a consensual hallucination, of course, and in the 1930s, the hallucination turned nightmare." "Jesus," I said. "Precisely," said Aniya. "Anyway, long before that, in 1909 A.D., the middle-aged Mr. Wright abandoned his wife and 6 children and ran away to Europe with a married woman." I admit that I blinked at this news. The thought of the old architect, a man in his mid-80s when we had met him 4 years ago, with a sex life and a scandalous one at that, took some getting used to. I also wondered what all this had to do with my question about Taliesin East. Aniya was getting to that. "When he returned with the other woman," she said, smiling at my rapt attention, "he began building the first Taliesin, his home in Wisconsin, for Mama." "His mother?" I said, totally confused. "Mama Borthwick," said Aniya, spelling the first name for me. "Mrs. Cheney, the other woman." "Oh." The smile fading, she continued. "The scandal had destroyed his architectural practice and made him a branded man in the United States. But he built Taliesin and forged ahead, trying to find new patrons. His first wife, Catherine, would not give him a divorce. The newspapers, those were databanks printed on paper and distributed regularly, thrived on such gossip and fanned the flames of the scandal, not letting it die." We had been walking in the courtyard when I asked Aniya the simple question about Taliesin, and I remember pausing by the fountain during this part of her answer. I was always amazed at what this child knew. "Then," she said, "on August 15, 1914, a worker at Taliesin went crazy, killed Mama Borthwick and her son John and daughter Martha with a hatchet, burned their bodies, set fire to the compound, and then killed 4 of Mr. Wright's friends and apprentices before swallowing acid himself. The entire place burned down." "My God," I whispered, looking toward the dining hall, where the cyborg old architect was having lunch with a few of his oldest apprentices, even as we spoke. "He never gave up," said Aniya. "A few days later, on August 18th, Mr. Wright was touring an artificial lake on the Taliesin property when the dam he was standing on gave way and he was swept into a rain-swollen creek. Against all odds, he swam out of the torrent. A few weeks later, he started to rebuild." I thought that I understood then what she was telling me about the old architect. "Why aren't we at Bat Taliesin?" I asked as we strolled away from the bubbling fountain in the desert courtyard. Aniya shook her head. "Good question. I doubt if it even exists in this rebuilt version of Earth. It was important to Mr. Wright, though. He died here, near Taliesin West, on April 9, 1959. But he was buried back near the Wisconsin Taliesin." I stopped walking then. The thought of the old architect dying was a new and disturbing thought. Everything about our exile had been steady state, calm and self-renewing. But now Ania had reminded me that everything and everyone ends, or had, before the Pax introduced the cruciform and physical resurrection to humanity. But no one at the Fellowship, perhaps no one on this kidnapped earth, had submitted to a cruciform. That conversation had been 3 years earlier. This morning, the week after the cybrid old architect's death and incongruous burial in the small mausoleum he had built out in the desert, we were ready to face the consequences of death without resurrection and the end of things. While Ania went off to the bath and laundry pavilion to wash up, I found Abetic and the two of us got busy with spreading the word of the meeting in the music pavilion. The blue-skinned android did not act surprised that Ania, the youngest of us, was calling and leading the meeting. Both Abetic and I had watched silently over the past few years as the girl became the locus of the Fellowship. I jogged from the fields to the dormitories, from the dormitories to the kitchen, where I rang the large bell set in the fanciful bell tower above the stairway to the guest deck. Those apprentices or workers whom I did not contact personally should hear the bell and come to investigate. From the kitchen, where I left cooks and some of the apprentices taking their aprons off and wiping their hands, I announced the meeting to people having coffee in the large Fellowship dining room. The view from this beautiful room looked north toward the McDowell Peaks, so some had watched Ania and me return and knew that something was up. And then I poked my head in Mr. Wright's smaller private dining room, empty, and then jogged over to the drafting room. This was probably the most attractive room in the compound, with its long rows of drafting tables and filing cabinets set under the sloping canvas roof, the morning light flooding in through the two rows of offset windows. The sun was high enough now to fall on the roof, and the smell of heated canvas was as pleasant as the butter-rich light. Ania had once told me that it was this sense of camping out, of working within the confines of light and canvas and stone, that had been the real reason for Mr. Wright coming west to the second Taliesin. There were 10 or 12 of the apprentices in the drafting room, all standing around, none working now that the old architect was no longer around to suggest projects, and I told them that Ania would like us to gather in the music pavilion. None protested. None grumbled or made any comment about a 16-year-old telling 90 of her elders to come together in the middle of a workday. If anything, the apprentices looked relieved to hear that she was back and taking charge. From the drafting room I went to the library, where I had spent so many happy hours, and then checked the conference room, lit only by 4 glowing panels in the floor, and announced the meeting to the people I found in both places. Then I jogged down the concrete path under the covered walkway of desert masonry, and peered in the cabaret theater, where the old architect had loved to show movies on Saturday nights. This place had always tickled me. Its thick stone walls and roof, the long descending space with plywood benches covered with red cushions, the well-worn red carpet on the floor, and the many hundreds of white Christmas lights running back and forth on the ceiling. When we first arrived, Ania and I were amazed to find that the old architect demanded that his apprentices and their families dress for dinner on Saturdays. Ancient tuxedos and black ties, of the sort one sees in the oldest history hollows. The women wore strange dresses out of antiquity. Mr. Wright provided the formal clothes for those who failed to bring them in their flight to Earth through Time Tombs or Farcaster. That first Saturday, Ania had shown up dressed in a tuxedo, shirt, and black tie, rather than one of the dresses provided. When I first saw the old architect's shocked expression, I was sure that he was going to throw us out of the Fellowship and make us eke out a living in the desert. But then the old face creased into a smile, and within seconds he was laughing. He never asked Ania to dress in anything else. After the formal Saturday dinners, we would either have a group musical event or assemble in the cabaret theater for a movie, one of the ancient celluloid kinds that had to be projected by a machine. It was rather like learning to enjoy cave art. Both Ania and I loved the films he chose,
ancient 20th century flat things, many in black and white. And for some reason that he never explained, Mr. Wright preferred to watch them with the soundtrack, optical jiggles and wiggles, visible on the screen. Actually, we'd watched films there for a year before one of the other apprentices told us that they had been made to be watched without the soundtrack visible. Today the cabaret theater was empty, the Christmas lights dark. I jogged on, moving from room to room, building to building, rounding up apprentices, workers, and family members until I met A. Bettick by the fountain and we joined the others in the large music pavilion. The pavilion was a large space with a broad stage and six rows of 18 upholstered seats in each row. The walls were of redwood painted Cherokee red, the old architect's favorite color, and the usual thick desert masonry. A grand piano and a few potted palms were the only things on the red-carpeted stage. Overhead, stretched tight above a gridwork of wood and steel ribs, was the usual white canvas. Ania had once told me that after the death of the first Mr. Wright, plastic had taken the place of canvas to relieve the necessity of replacing canvas every couple of years. But upon this Mr. Wright's return, the plastic was ripped out, as was the glass above the main drafting room, so that pure light through white canvas would be the rule once again. A. Bettick and I stood near the rear of the music pavilion as the murmuring apprentices and other workers took their seats, some of the construction workers standing on the aisle steps or at the back with the android and me, as if worried about tracking mud and dust onto the rich carpet and upholstery. When Ania entered through the side curtains and jumped to the stage, all the conversation stopped. The acoustics were good in Mr. Wright's music pavilion, but Ania had always been able to project her voice without seeming to raise it. She spoke softly. "Thank you for gathering. I thought we should talk." Jaev Peters, one of the older apprentices, immediately stood up in the fifth row. "You were gone, Ania, in the desert again." The girl on the stage nodded. "Did you talk to the lions and tigers and bears?" No one in the audience tittered or giggled. The question was asked in deadly seriousness, and the answer was awaited by 90 people just as seriously. I should explain. It all began in the Kantos Martin Silenus wrote more than 2 centuries ago. That tale of the Hyperion pilgrims, the Shrike, and the battle between humanity and the Technocore explained how the early cyberspace webs had evolved into planetary dataspheres. By the time of the hegemony, the AI Technocore had used their secret Farcaster and Fatline technology to weave hundreds of dataspheres into a single, secret, interstellar information medium called the Megasphere. But according to the Kantos, Ania's father, the cyber John Keats, had traveled in disembodied data persona form to the Megasphere's core and discovered that there was a larger datum plane medium, perhaps larger than our galaxy, which even the core AIs were afraid to explore, because it was full of lions and tigers and bears. Those were Uman the AI's words. These were the beings, or intelligences, or gods for all we knew, who had kidnapped the Earth and brought it here before the core could destroy it a millennium ago. These lions and tigers and bears were the bugaboo guardians of our world. No one in the Fellowship had ever seen any of these entities, or spoken to them, or had any solid evidence of their existence. No one except Ania. "No," said the girl on the stage. "I didn't talk to them." She looked down as if embarrassed. She was always reticent to talk about this. "But I think I heard them." "They spoke to you?" said Jaev Peters. The pavilion was hushed. "No," said Ania. "I didn't say that. I just heard them, a bit like when you overhear someone else's conversation through a dormitory wall." There was a rustle of amusement at this, for all the thick stone walls on the Fellowship property, the dorm partitions were notably thin. "All right," said Betts Kimball from the first row. Betts was the chief cook and a large, sensible woman. "Tell us what they said."
Aeneas stepped up to the edge of the red-carpeted stage and looked out at her elders and colleagues.
"I can tell you this," she said softly. "There'll be no more food and supplies from the Indian market. That's gone." It was as if she had set off a grenade in the music pavilion. When the babble began to subside, one of the biggest of the construction workers, a man named Hussan, shouted over the noise.
"What do you mean it's gone? Where do we get our food?"
There was good reason for the panic. In Mr. Wright's day, way back in the 20th century, his fellowship desert camp had been about 50 kilometers from a large town called Phoenix. Unlike the Depression-era Wisconsin Taliesin, where apprentices raised crops in the rich soil even while they worked on Mr. Wright's construction plans, this desert camp had never been able to grow its own food. So they drove to Phoenix and bartered or paid out their primitive coins and paper money for basic supplies. The old architect had always depended upon the largesse of patrons, large loans never to be paid back, for such month-to-month survival. Here, in our reassembled desert camp, there were no towns. The only road, two gravel ruts, led west into hundreds of miles of emptiness. I knew this because I had flown over the area in the dropship and driven it in the old architect's ground car. But about 30 clicks from the compound, there was a weekly Indian market, where we had bartered craft items for food and basic materials. It had been there for years before Aeneas and my arrival. Everyone had obviously expected it to be there forever.
"What do you mean it's gone?" repeated Hussan in a hoarse shout. "Where'd the Indians go? Were they just cybered illusions like Mr. Wright?"
Aeneas made a gesture with her hands that I had grown accustomed to over the years, a graceful setting-aside motion that I had come to see as a physical analog of the Zen expression, mu, which in the right context can mean, unask the question. "The market's gone because we won't need it anymore," said Aeneas. "The Indians are real enough, Navajo, Apache, Hopi, and Zuni. But they have their own lives to live, their own experiments to conduct. Their trading with us has been a favor." The crowd became angry at that, but eventually they settled down again. Betts Kimball stood.
"What do we do, child?"
Aeneas sat on the edge of the stage, as if trying to become one with the waiting, expectant audience.
"The fellowship is over," she said. "That part of our lives has to end."
One of the younger apprentices was shouting from the back of the pavilion.
"No, it doesn't. Mr. Wright could still return. He was a cybrid, remember? A construct. The core, or the lions and tigers and bears, whoever shaped him can send him back to us."
Aeneas shook her head, sadly but firmly.
"No, Mr. Wright is gone. The fellowship is over. Without the food and materials the Indians brought from so far away, this desert camp can't last a month. We have to go."
It was a young female apprentice named Parrot who spoke quietly into the silence.
"Where, Aeneas?"
Perhaps it was at this moment that I first realized how this entire group had given themselves over to the young woman I had known as a child. When the old architect was around, giving lectures, holding forth in seminars and drafting room bull sessions, leading his flock on picnics and swimming outings in the mountains, demanding solicitude and the best food, the reality of Aeneas' leadership had been somewhat masked. But now it was evident.
"Yes," someone else called from the center of the rising row of seats.
"Where, Aeneas?"
My friend opened her hands in another gesture I had learned. Rather than unask the question, this one said, "You must answer your own question." Aloud, she said,
"There are two choices. Each of you traveled here either by Farcaster or through the Time Tombs. You can go back by way of Farcaster."
"No. How can we?"
"Never. I'd rather die."
"No, the packs will find us and kill us."
The cries were immediate and from the heart. It was the sound of terror made verbal. I smelled fear in the room the way I used to smell it on animals caught in leg traps on the moors of Hyperion. Aeneas lifted a hand and the outcries faded. You can return to Pax Space by Farcaster. Or you can stay on Earth and try to fend for yourself.
There were murmurs, and I could hear relief at the option of not returning. I understood that feeling. The Pax had come to be a boogeyman to me as well. The thought of returning there sent me gasping up out of sleep at least once a week.
But if you stay here, continued the girl seated on the edge of Mr. Wright's music stage, you will be outcasts. All of the groups of human beings here are involved in their own projects, their own experiments. You will not fit in there.
People shouted questions about that, demanding answers to mysteries not understood during their long stay here. But Aeneia continued with what she was saying.
If you stay here, you will waste what Mr. Wright has taught you and what you came to learn about yourself. The Earth does not need architects and builders. Not now. We have to go back.
Jaev Peters spoke again. His voice was brittle, but not angry.
And does the Pax need builders and architects? To build its cross-damned churches?
Yes, said Aeneia.
Jaev pounded the back of the seat in front of him with his large fist.
But they'll capture or kill us if they learn who we are, where we've been.
Yes, said Aeneia.
Betts Kimball said,
Are you going back, child?
Yes, said Aeneia, and pushed herself away from the stage.
Everyone was standing now, shouting or talking to the people next to them. It was Jaev Peters who spoke the thoughts of the 90 Fellowship orphans.
Can we go with you, Aeneia?
The girl sighed. Her face, as sunburned and alert as it looked this morning, also looked tired.
No, she said. I think that leaving here is like dying or being born. We each have to do it alone. She smiled. Or in very small groups.
The room fell silent then. When Aeneia spoke, it was as if a single instrument were picking up where the orchestra had stopped.
Rawl will leave first, she said. Tonight. One by one, each of you will find the right Farcaster portal. I will help you. I will be the last to leave Earth. But leave I will, and within a few weeks. We all must go.
People pushed forward then, still silent, but moving closer to the girl with the short cropped hair.
But some of us will meet again, said Aeneia. I feel certain that some of us will meet again.
I heard the flip side of that reassuring prediction. Some of us would not survive to meet again.
Well?
Boomed Betts Kimball, standing with one broad arm around Aeneia.
We have enough food in the kitchen for one last feast. Lunch today will be a meal you'll remember for years. If you have to travel, as my mom used to say, never travel on an empty stomach. Who's to help me in the kitchen, then?
The groups broke up then, families and friends in clusters, loners standing as if stunned, everyone moving closer to Aeneia as we began filing out of the music pavilion. I wanted to grab her at that moment, shake her until her wisdom teeth fell out, and demand, What the hell do you mean Rawl will leave first tonight? Who the hell are you to tell me to leave you behind? And how do you think you can make me? But she was too far away and too many people were pressing around her. The best I could do was stride along behind the crowd as it moved toward the kitchen and dining area, anger written in my face, fists, muscles, and walk. Once I saw Aeneia glance back, straining to find me over the heads of the crowd around her, and her eyes pleaded,
Let me explain.
I stared back stonily, giving her nothing. It was almost dusk when she joined me in the large garage Mr. Wright had ordered built, half a click east of the compound. The structure was open on the sides, except for canvas curtains, but it had thick stone columns supporting a permanent redwood roof. It had been built to shelter the dropship in which Aeneia, Abetic, and I had arrived. I had pulled back the main canvas door and was standing in the open hatch of the dropship when I saw Aeneia crossing the desert toward me. On my wrist was the comlog bracelet that I had not worn in more than a year. The thing held much of the memory of our former spaceship, the consul's ship from centuries ago, and it had been my liaison and tutor when I had learned to fly the dropship. I did not need it now. The comm log memory had been downloaded into the dropship, and I had become rather good at piloting the dropship on my own. But it made me feel more secure. The comm log was also running a systems check on the ship, chatting with itself, you might say. Aeneas stood just within the folded canvas. The sunset threw long shadows behind her and painted the canvas red. "How's the dropship?" she said. I glanced at the comm log readings. "All right," I grunted, not looking her way. "Does it have enough fuel and charge for one more flight?" Still not looking up, fiddling with touch plates on the arm of the pilot's chair inside the hatch, I said, "Depends on where it's flying to." Aeneas walked to the dropship stairway and touched my leg. "Rawl." This time I had to look at her. "Don't be angry," she said. "We have to do these things." I pulled my leg away.
"God damn it, don't keep telling me and everyone else what we have to do. You're just a kid. Maybe there are things some of us don't have to do. Maybe going off on my own and leaving you behind is one of those."
I stepped off the ladder and tapped the comm log. The stairs morphed back into the dropship hall. I left the garage and began walking toward my tent. On the horizon, the sun was a perfect red sphere. In the last low rays of light, the stones and canvas of the main compound looked as if they had caught fire, the old architect's greatest fear. "Rawl, wait!" Aeneas hurried to catch up to me. One glance in her direction told me how exhausted she was. All afternoon she had been meeting with people, talking to people, explaining to people, reassuring people, hugging people. I had come to think of the Fellowship as a nest of emotional vampires, and Aeneas as their only source of energy.
"You said that you would..." she began.
"Yeah, yeah," I interrupted. I suddenly had the sense that she was the adult and that I was the petulant child. To hide my confusion, I turned away again and watched the last of the sunset. For a moment or two, we were both silent, watching the light fade and the sky darken. I had decided that Earth sunsets were slower and more lovely than the Hyperion sunsets I had known as a child, and the desert sunsets were particularly fine. How many sunsets had this child and I shared in the past 4 years? How many lazy evenings of dinner and conversation under the brilliant desert stars? Could this really be the last sunset we would watch together? The idea made me sick and furious.
"Rawl," she said again, when the shadows had grown together and the air was cooling. "Will you come with me?"
I did not say yes, but I followed her across the rocky field, avoiding the bayonet spikes of yucca and the spines of low cacti in the gloom, until we came into the lighted area of the compound. How long, I wondered, until the fuel oil for the generators runs out? This answer I knew. It was part of my job to keep the generators maintained and fueled. We had 6 days' supply in the main tanks and another 10 days in the reserve tanks that were never to be touched except in emergency. With the Indian market gone, there would be no resupply. Almost 3 weeks of electric lights and refrigeration and power equipment, and then... what? Darkness, decay, and an end to the incessant construction, tearing down, and rebuilding that had been the background noise at Taliesin for the last 4 years. I thought perhaps that we were going to the dining hall, but we walked past those lighted windows, groups of people still sitting at the tables, talking earnestly, glancing up with eyes only for Aeneas as we passed. I was invisible to them in their hour of panic, and then we approached Mr. Wright's private drafting studio and his office. But we did not stop there, nor did we stop in the beautiful little conference room where a small group sat to watch a final movie, 3 weeks until the movie projectors did not run, nor did we turn into the main drafting room. Our destination was a stone and canvas workshop set far down the driveway on the south side,
a useful outbuilding for working with toxic chemicals or noisy equipment. I had worked here often in the first couple of years at the fellowship, but not in recent months. A. Bedick was waiting at the door. The android had a slight smile on his bland blue face, rather like the one he had worn when carrying the birthday cake to Aenea's surprise party. "What?" I said, still irritated, looking from the girl's tired face to the android's smug expression. Aenea stepped into the workshop and turned on the light. On the work table, in the center of the little room, sat a small boat, not much more than 2 meters in length. It was shaped rather like a seed sharpened on both ends, enclosed except for a single round cockpit opening with a nylon skirt that could obviously be tightened around the occupant's waist. A two-bladed paddle lay on the table next to the boat. I stepped closer and ran my hand over the hull. A polished fiberglass compound with internal aluminum braces and fittings. Only one other person at the fellowship could do such careful work. I looked at A. Bedick almost accusingly. He nodded. "It's called a kayak," said Aenea, running her own hand over the polished hull. "It's an old Earth design. I've seen variations on it," I said, refusing to be impressed.
"The Iceclaw Ursus rebels used small boats like this."
Aenea was still stroking the hull, all of her attention there. It was as if I had not spoken. "I asked A. Bedick to make it for you," she said. "He's worked for weeks here."
"For me," I said dully. My stomach tightened at the realization of what was coming.
Aenea moved closer. She was standing directly under the hanging light, and the shadows under her eyes and cheekbones made her look much older than 16. "We don't have the raft anymore, Rawl."
I knew the raft she meant.
The one that had carried us across so many worlds until it was chopped up in the ambush that almost killed us on God's Grove. The raft that had carried us down the river under the ice on Sol Draconi Septim, and through the deserts of Hebron and on Qumriad, and across the world ocean of Mare Infinitus. I knew the raft she meant. And I knew what this boat meant. "So I'm to take this back the way we came?" I raised a hand as if to touch the thing, but then did not.
"Not the way we came," said Aenea. "But down the river Tethys, across different worlds, across as many worlds as it takes to find the ship."
"The ship?" I said.
We had left the consul's spaceship hiding under a river, repairing itself from damage sustained in our flight from the Pax, on a world whose name and location we did not know. My young friend nodded, and the shadows fled, then regrouped around her tired eyes.
"We'll need the ship, Rawl. If you would, I'd like you to take this kayak down the river Tethys until you find the ship, then fly back with it to a world where A. Bedick and I will be waiting."
"A world in Pax space?" I said, my stomach tightening another notch at the danger present in that simple sentence.
"Yes."
"Why me?" I said, looking significantly at A. Bedick. I was ashamed at my thought then. "Why send a human being, your best friend, when the android can go?" I lowered my gaze.
"It will be a dangerous trip," said Aenea. "I believe that you can do it, Rawl. I trust you to find the ship and then find us."
I felt my shoulders slump.
"All right," I said. "Do we head back to where we came through the Farcaster before?" We had come through from God's Grove on a small stream near the old architect's masterpiece building, Falling Water. It was 2/3 of a continent away.
"No," said Aenea. "Closer, on the Mississippi River."
"All right," I said again. I had flown over the Mississippi. It was almost 2,000 clicks east of here. "When do I go? Tomorrow?"
Aenea touched my wrist.
"No," she said, tiredly but firmly. "Tonight. Right now."
I did not protest. I did not argue. Without speaking, I took the bow of the kayak. A. Bedick took the stern. Aenea held the center steady.
and we carried the damn thing back to the dropship in the deepening desert night.
Chapter 3. The Grand Inquisitor was late. Vatican Airspace Traffic Control routed the Inquisitor's EMV across normally closed airspace near the spaceport, shut down all airborne traffic on the east side of the Vatican, and held a 30,000-ton robot freighter in orbital final approach until after the GI's car had flown across the southeast corner of the landing grid. Inside the specially armored EMV, the Grand Inquisitor, His Eminence John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa, did not glance out the window or at the video monitors at the lovely sight of the approaching Vatican, its walls rosy in the morning light, or at the busy 20-lane highway called the Ponte Vittorio Emanuele beneath them, glimmering like a sunlit river because of sunlight on windshields and bubble tops. The Grand Inquisitor's attention was focused solely on the intelligence update, scrolling by on his comlog template. When the last paragraph had scrolled past and was committed to memory and deleted to oblivion, the Grand Inquisitor said to his aide, Father Farrell,
"And there have been no more meetings with the Mercantilis."
Father Farrell, a thin man with flat gray eyes, never smiled, but a twitch of his cheek muscle conveyed the simulation of humor to the Cardinal. "None."
"You're certain?"
"Absolutely." The Grand Inquisitor sat back in the EMV's cushions and allowed himself a brief smile. The Mercantilis had made only that one early, disastrous approach to any of the papal candidates, the sounding out of Lourdesami, and the Inquisitor had heard the complete recording of that meeting. The Cardinal allowed himself another few seconds of smile. Lourdesami had been right to think that his conference room was bug-proof, absolutely resistant to taps, bugs, wires, and squirts. Any recording device in the room, even implanted in one of the participants, would have been detected and homed in on. Any attempt to tight-beam out would have been detected and blocked. It had been one of the Grand Inquisitor's finest moments, getting the complete visual and auditory recording of that meeting. Monsignor Lucas Oddi had gone into the Vatican Hospital for a routine eyes, ears, and heart replacement 2 local years ago. The surgeon had been approached by Father Farrell, and the full weight of the Holy Office had been shown ready to descend upon the poor medico's neck if he did not implant certain state-of-the-art devices in the Monsignor's body. The surgeon did so and died the true death, no resurrection possible, in a car accident far out over the Big North Shallow shortly after that. Monsignor Lucas Oddi had no electronic or mechanical bugs in his system, but connected to his optic nerve were 7 fully biological nanorecorders. 4 auditory nanorecorders were tapped into his auditory nerve system. These biorecorders did not transmit inside the body, but stored the data in chemical form and physically carried it through the bloodstream to the squirt transmitter, also fully organic, set into Monsignor Oddi's left ventricle. 10 minutes after Oddi had left the secured area of Cardinal Lourdesami's office, the transmitter had squirted a compressed record of the meeting to one of the Grand Inquisitor's nearby relay transponders. It was not real-time eavesdropping from Lourdesami's bug-proof rooms, a fact that still worried Cardinal Mustafa, but it was as close to it as current technology and stealth could get. "Isozaki is frightened," said Father Farrell. "He thinks..." The Grand Inquisitor raised one finger. Farrell stopped in mid-sentence.
"You do not know that he is frightened," said the Cardinal. "You do not know what he thinks. You can only know what he says and does, and infer his thoughts and reactions from that. Never make unsupportable assumptions about your enemies, Martin. It can be a fatal self-indulgence."
Father Farrell bowed his head in agreement and submission. The EMV touched down on the landing pad atop Castel Sant'Angelo. The Grand Inquisitor was out the hatch and down the ramp so quickly that Farrell had to trot to catch up to his master.
Security commandos, dressed in Holy Office red armor cloth, fell into escort step ahead and behind. But the Grand Inquisitor waved them away. He wanted to finish his conversation with Father Farrell. He touched his aide's left arm, not out of affection, but to close the bone conduction circuits so that he could sub-vocalize, and said,
"Isozaki and the Mercantilist leaders are not frightened. If Lord Usami wanted them purged, they would be dead by now. Isozaki had to get his message of support to the Cardinal, and he did. It's the Pax military who are frightened."
Farrell frowned and sub-vocalized on the bone circuit. "The military? But they haven't played their card yet. They have done nothing disloyal."
"Precisely," said the Grand Inquisitor. "The Mercantilis has made its move and knows that Lord Usami will turn to them when the time comes. Pax Fleet and the rest have been terrified for years that they'll make the wrong choice. Now they're terrified that they've waited too long."
Farrell nodded. They had taken a drop shaft deep into the stone bowels of Castel Sant'Angelo, and now they moved past armed guards and through lethal force fields down a dark corridor. At an unmarked door, two red-garbed commandos stood at attention, energy rifles raised.
"Leave us," said the Grand Inquisitor, and palmed the door's ID plate. The steel panel slid up and out of sight. The corridor had been stone and shadows. Inside the room, everything was bright light, instruments, and sterile surfaces. Technicians looked up as the Grand Inquisitor and Farrell entered. One wall of the room was taken up by square doors, looking like nothing so much as the multi-tiered human file drawers of an ancient morgue. One of those doors was open, and a naked man lay on a gurney that had been pulled from the cold storage drawer there. The Grand Inquisitor and Farrell stopped on either side of the gurney.
"He is reviving well," said the technician who stood at the console. "We're holding him just beneath the surface. We can bring him up in seconds,"
Father Farrell said. "How long was his last cold sleep?"
16 local months," said the technician. 13 and a half standard."
"Bring him up," said the Grand Inquisitor.
The man's eyelids began to flutter within seconds. He was a small man, muscular but compact, and there were no marks or bruises on his body. His wrists and ankles were bound by sticktite. A cortical shunt had been implanted just behind his left ear, and an almost invisible bundle of microfibers ran from it to the console. The man on the gurney moaned.
"Corporal Bassinkey," said the Grand Inquisitor, "can you hear me?"
Corporal Key made an unintelligible sound. The Grand Inquisitor nodded, as if satisfied.
"Corporal Key,"
he said pleasantly, conversationally,
"shall we pick up where we left off?"
"How long," mumbled Key between dry, stiff lips, "how long have I been?" Father Farrell had moved to the technician's console. Now he nodded to the Grand Inquisitor. Ignoring the corporal's question, John Domenico Cardinal Mustafa said softly,
"Why did you and Father Captain de Soya let the girl go?"
Corporal Key had opened his eyes, blinking as if the light pained him, but now he closed them again. He did not speak. The Grand Inquisitor nodded to his aide. Father Farrell's hand passed over icons on the console disk key, but did not yet activate any of them.
"Once again," said the Grand Inquisitor, "why did you and de Soya allow the girl and her criminal allies to escape on God's Grove? Who were you working for? What was your motivation?"
Corporal Key lay on his back, his fists clenched and his eyes shut